and journalist, dramatist, and teacher. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. That description has left me feeling quite exhausted. An expression about jack of all trades and master of none. Right. I do my best.
How did you get into working in drama production, becoming a drama writer?
I would say I was more of a drama person than I was a journalist. Although, in a way, it could be described as starting as a fusion. When I was a youngster at my first school, our teacher read from Samuel Pepys's diary, the Old Testament, you know, the bloodiest, goriest, and most tragic and violent biblical stories, you could say. She was also very encouraging when it came to drama productions. My imagination was lit up. I was very precocious. One afternoon when she asked us what were we going to do, what should we do for our annual play, I put up my hand and volunteered to produce and direct Hamlet. So that's where it really started. The Pepys side of thing, in a way, Samuel Pepys, who was the chronicler in 17th century London during the Great Plague and the Fire of London, even though his diary was a secret diary, he was very much a journalist. Those seeds were planted, and so there's always been this conviventia between informing and supporting each other between drama and journalism. I've never thought of myself as a particularly good journalist because I'm rather shy. I find it very difficult to ask people questions. But I am always drawn to dramatic situations. And I suppose the drama of world events, drawn into being a specialist legal affairs correspondent covering trials and legal cases, you know, the ritual drama of the adversarial process. When my journalism developed in radio, in independent radio in the United Kingdom, I had a wonderful start to my radio journalism career. I was working nationally for British Independent Radio News Service that also worked in the same building as the speech stick commercial station for London in the late 70s through the 80s. The drama, but the desire to write creatively came back, and I teamed up with an old school friend of mine, Richard Shannon, who was in community theatre. We decided to do drama for Independent Radio and LBC, which was London Station, and our first project was a dramatisation of Samuel Pepys's diary, and it was hugely successful. Because, I suppose, the station was news-orientated. And then we were encouraged to do more because our audience figures increased hugely. We did classical literature, Charles Dickens novels. We originated our own historical storytelling from the Mutiny of the Bounty to the Borgias, Mary, Queen of Scots. And at that time, British Independent Radio had a public service remit with opportunities. A proportion of commercial stations' profits could be offset from taxation and also from a levy going to the National Regulatory Authority if they invested the money in cultural projects. And so we were very fortunate. We got a budget to do a modern English translation of Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, and we dramatised that. Things began to fall into place. A building society, financial institute that provides mortgages and saving opportunities for people, had a community policy, and they wanted to invest in a new writing competition. So we set up a national young radio playwrights competition. And then the Arts Council for Britain wanted to encourage new writing and its relationship with live theatre in London. So things began to fall into place. And another huge advantage was my partner at the time. She was a web designer. In the early years of the internet, we pioneered sound drama on the internet. So in addition to new plays being produced on LBC and being distributed in the British local radio, independent local radio network, and in addition to doing stage theatre versions, we also presented the work online. And that proved hugely successful.
What was it like to create radio adaptations of history and literature, things like you had mentioned the Canterbury Tales or Samuel Pepys's diary?
For me, being the journalist, it was like working to a deadline. It was in my mind, I took the source material and I applied the discipline that the listener is easily distracted, although a highly intelligent audience. And you should do everything you can to make every sound, every second of word, dramatic and narrative imperative, hugely interesting and entertaining. My discipline in journalism was that sometimes I had to explain the most complicated legal stories in 30 seconds to a demographic that was wide-ranging, much more popular than the BBC's. So that was the thinking behind it. My colleague Richard Shannon was the professional director, and he taught me direction. We helped each other. I mean, being the quick, fast, popular writer, he said I helped to inspire him. And actually, I'm sure you're familiar with the stories of Orson Welles' Mercury Theatre on the Air, and how they would work week to week, and sometimes they wouldn't know what they would be doing on the Sunday of the broadcast next Sunday. Well, it was a bit like that at LBC. And give you some idea of how much serendipity and contingency there was. We really were in a situation where we had no idea what we were going to do for the following week. And we were all under pressure. And Richard said, we need to do a spy story. We haven't done a spy story yet. I had left school at 16, although I had a very good education up until that time. I hadn't had the privilege of going to university. I thought I'd read widely, but clearly not enough. I went to a famous bookshop in London called Foyles in the Charing Cross Road and looked at their espionage spy section and picked out something that seemed to be appropriate, The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, without actually reading the novel from beginning to end, I started dramatising it in terms of chapter by chapter. And in the process, immediately discovered what a brilliant and hugely significant writer of literature Joseph Conrad was. He was also very dramatic. I didn't know at the time he was a very successful dramatist. He dramatised novels, and they were very successful in London's West End in the Edwardian period and through the Great War up until the 1920s. So that kind of drive and excitement was all part of that, and it was highly educational. Coincidentally, when I eventually did a literature degree, I majored in the Victorian novelists and did my dissertation on Conrad's Heart of Darkness and Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I dramatised. Another hugely supportive and exciting break for us was that NPR in the United States of America, which in the 80s and 90s still commissioned and distributed radio drama to their affiliate stations by satellite. And they got to hear about us, and they offered to go into co-production with us. And so now we did The Secret Agent first for LBC. It was hugely successful. They bought that, and then they offered to go into a co-production for Conrad's novel The Heart of Darkness. They also did that for Bram Stoker's Dracula. And it was hugely thrilling to be able to produce original classical dramatisations for London, which is a wonderful radio market. It's a rich, exciting, multicultural city with such diverse backgrounds. And then to get reaction when the productions were heard around the United States of America. This was interesting because it was in a country where whenever you mention the word radio drama, everybody would say, well, think about the BBC, because the BBC's output was quite outstanding and massive, you know, world-leading. And even this year, today, it's the largest producer of sound radio drama, 650 hours a year. But what was so interesting was that we provided an alternative. The new writers we produced tended to be young writers on the margins, hadn't been, not part of the establishment, not the kind of voices that would necessarily be expected to be heard on the main cultural, national cultural news channel, BBC Radio 4. And of course, the BBC have the additional luxury of having what could be described as a high culture channel, Radio 3, which originally was known as the Third Programme. Started from 1948. We were certainly criticised, and many of the BBC radio drama apparatchiks were anxious and competitive. They said some pretty funny things about us. Some of the critics said that we had a tendency to produce young, anxious voices, preoccupied with human misery and the agony, the existential agony of postmodernism. It's quite funny thinking about it at the time. And we also had a nickname because we started teaching, Richard and I, we both started doing visiting lecturing at Goldsmiths College, University of London, which is south of the river. We had this nickname, Those Boys South of the River. I suppose that's kind of it's an expression of snobbery, the idea that everything significant and important culturally happens north of the river, which is quite ridiculous because our national theatre is on the South Bank. What was so thrilling about it was that the audience to LBC was certainly more popular and more diverse. And it's not an apocryphal anecdote. We would get into a taxi and we'd hear a taxi driver tuned in to, you know, our dramatisation of The Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens's Tale of Two Cities. And we did it in 5 minutes, 10-minute episodes. He would, when the news came on afterwards, he would say, absolutely fantastic drama you're getting on LBC these days. And, you know, he didn't know who we were. He said, it's so interesting. He said, one of the taxi drivers, he said, I went and bought my first book to read it. Another thing we did, we were always interested in experimentation. We decided to produce fairly early on our sound dramas in cinematic surround sound, Dolby Pro Logic. Very few people listened on FM to radio in surround sound, but we did it anyway. And then we set up a weekly club and we'd invite regular listeners to our audio dramas and writers involved in our writing schemes. They could come to a large room at LBC and we'd set up, you know, a Dolby Pro Logic surround sound system and place the seats in the middle, and so that they could then listen in surround sound and then and they could talk about the play afterwards. Fortunately, our plays were quite short. The new play is maximum 20, 25 minutes, although we did produce some hour-long. Another dimension to it was that because we were the alternative, we were young in mind and heart, and the script hadn't been written for us. Really promising new writers who are now not not necessarily household names, but leading dramatic writers, screen playwrights of our age, Martin McDonagh, for example, and Simon Beaufoy. They were first produced by us in our new writing schemes. One of the new writers we produced four times, James Payne. We're delighted that he's now a very, very successful television screenplay writer. That's something to take from what was a period of working 7 days a week, sometimes working through the night. I think it's something that the madness, as it were, is the privilege of the young. But it's enormously thrilling. And it gave me also an opportunity to direct theatre stage plays. So the idea behind this was that the dynamic between stage theatre and sound radio drama enabled writers to explore the role of sound, the significance of physical theatre in relation to their storytelling. And when we ran those schemes, they would write a specific version for the radio, which we would produce either before the theatre or after. And then they would develop their radio play into a theatre version, and that would be workshopped. That was very interesting and pioneering. In 1 year, I mean, we invited outside directors to come in. In 1 year, where we had four writers who'd been selected, two of the plays were produced first by radio with the same cast and then developed into theatre. And the other two were developed into theatre first and then produced for their radio versions. So there we are. It's and it's made me devoted to sound drama and radio drama as an academic, as a teacher, as a listener. I'm absolutely nuts about it. I copy as much as I can every sound play that's produced and transmitted by the BBC, and I do my very best to listen to them, and I really enjoy encouraging our students at Goldsmiths to develop their sound storytelling ability and produce their own plays.
And to that end, you were involved in something called the Independent Radio Drama Production.
Yes, that was the name of our company. Yes, we formed our own company. It was a kind of arts company. And it ran from, it was first incorporated in 1997. And then we ceased operations in 2002.
I wanted to ask, though, you've also written a couple of textbooks on writing audio dramas or radio dramas. How did those come about?
Well, the first one, Radio Drama History and Practice, that was written under the most unbearable pressure. I was not burning two candles at both ends, but if a human being could have like six candles in different directions, they were all lit at the same time. And I was still working as a journalist. I started teaching in a university, also doing the dramas. And an academic yourself, you have an obligation to write and publish. Now, this was a practice media text, and I was a practice academic, still am. So I was persuaded to write a book on radio drama, and I did actually write that in the middle of the night. It was the 1999 text, wasn't it?
Yes.
Published by Routledge. It was an expression of everything I passionately believed in and thought about, and all of my knowledge that I'd acquired until then. I was, I think, undoubtedly had an attitude towards the BBC, thought they could do better. Which justified their attitude towards me, actually. I actually think, I hope it doesn't sound patronising, I think BBC's radio drama and sound drama has hugely improved. But perhaps it was always very, very good and I wasn't clever enough to realise. But it was, I mean, I hope I was fair to the BBC in that book. But I do feel that the new book, Writing Audio Drama, will redress some of the... some things lacking in that 1999 text. Radio drama, history, theory, and practice, it tried to cover a lot of things. It tried to be to do a cultural study of sound drama. It tried to cover writing audio drama, directing, producing sound drama, and looking at what I describe as the phantom distinction, the idea that documentary and drama are nearly synonymous in terms of storytelling. I've always seen journalism and drama being very much related in their skills and their art form. The new textbook, which I hope to have published in 2015 and finished writing this year, is looking at the history of how to write sound dramas. I've studied in English-speaking texts, primarily British and North American texts. Everything that's been written and talked about, you know, how to write the best sound play, what are the rules, if there are any, where's the inspiration drawn from? It's a combination of an academic study of everything I've been able to find that's been talked about and written about in terms of the art of writing sound dramas, a guide and a support to people who, you know, want to write sound drama in, you know, 2014 in the 21st century. So that's involved a faithful and committed study of, for example, the first book ever written about how to write radio drama. It was published in 1926. It was written by somebody called Gordon Lee, who was producing radio drama for the BBC in Newcastle upon Tyne. And it has a foreword by the first director of British drama, BBC Drama Productions, somebody called R.E. Jeffrey, who came from Aberdeen. I've looked at all of the articles that people were writing on radio drama in the 1920s in the Radio Times that started in 1923, in the Listener magazine, which is a kind of high culture BBC periodical that started in 1929. Been looking at newspapers such as The Guardian, the Critical Reviewing, right up until the present time. What is the purpose of the endeavour? What's the consensus? Eric Barnow, you know, the great, he's a great radio drama director, and then one of the finest cultural historians of United States broadcasting. I actually had the privilege of meeting him and hearing him do a presentation at a Pre-Italia in Italy in 1997. He's no longer with us. He wrote an absolutely magnificent, brilliant text towards the end of the 1940s. So that's the purpose of the second text.
As many of our readers know, because this is the reason that our show exists, in the latter half of 2012, CBC One, which is the radio station in Canada that produces radio dramas, received a funding cut, and they responded to that by completely eliminating their radio drama productions after 87 consecutive years on the air. And there have been other private enterprises that have been trying to produce audio drama in Canada, such as Dakota Ring Theater, which does get some airtime on other private stations. And we here at CITR 101.9 FM are attempting to get a couple of radio broadcast dramas off the ground. And I was just wondering, do you have any advice for relatively inexperienced groups of people that might be getting together to get projects like that off the ground?
Yes. Well, first of all, congratulations for having the initiative, the imagination, and the energy to do that. I'm very sorry that CBC ended its support for a great art form. In the 1999 book I wrote, Radio Drama Theory and Practice, I complimented and acknowledged the great contribution that CBC had made. And the CBC drama producers actually gave me photographs to use in the book. My advice is be very entrepreneurial, seek funding in order to be able to engage professional consultancy, a professional director, or at the very least, professional actors. And in terms of ideas for fundraising, I think young people are much more imaginative than I can, because I think in the 21st century, in liberal capitalist societies, ingenuity and imagination is greatly needed to survive and get on. But for example, using the internet, crowd source funding, going to arts bodies, going to charitable philanthropic trusts, linking up with professional broadcasters such as television and film, where you can bring an educational dimension to it in terms of a new writing competition. And that can often attract funding. In a liberal capitalist society, corporations, still in 2014, despite globalization, there's pressure from nation states and federal states to show social corporate involvement, community activities, community funding. Try everything. Bubble with enthusiasm. Be enormously disciplined. And going into partnership with professionals, I think with a sound drama project, it would be lovely to have mentors. Seek out some of those brilliant radio drama directors that I assume CBC retired early, I hope not prematurely. Combine and collaborate with theatre directors. Essentially, use the generation of your intrinsic enthusiasm and passion to give force to your marketing and make a big noise about it everywhere. One way of generating interest, for example, in a pre-produced sound drama that's going to go out on the radio station or on the internet, you could, and this could also support funding, you could have a live reading, you could have a live performance in a theatre space, simulating what people would do around the microphone. That can create quite a buzz. As well as being a social event, it could become a fundraising event. And at the same time, that helps to promote sound drama. Do those ideas help at all?
Yes, I believe so. I know that I've interviewed on the show a couple of internet series producers who have gone to crowdsource funding sites such as Kickstarter.com to fund their projects. It does. I know a number of semi-professional organizations here in Vancouver that do crowdsource funding of that sort, because we have a bit of a film and television production industry here in Vancouver, and also there is a production for voiceover work, which is animation, radio commercials, that sort of thing.
Right.
And a lot of that particular work is very similar in terms of the day-to-day runnings of how you do audio tracks for animation, for example, is quite similar to what you would do to record the audio tracks for a radio drama.
Another idea that occurred to me, and I'm thinking of U.S. Radio drama history, the longest-running radio drama was Lux. Lux Theatre, Lux Cinema and Theatre, which did a radio dramatization of Hollywood films. I've always wondered whether you could achieve a return to that if you have a film industry and an output. For example, Canadian films produced every year between 10 and the equivalent of 10 and 20,000 pounds could produce a sound drama equivalent of the film, you know, that could be seen as a cross promotional device deployment, as well as providing an opportunity in the sound drama medium. The actors and the director might be interested in being involved. The same thing can happen in relation to funded or commercial, you know, state-funded, grant-funded, or commercial theatre. Sound drama, audio drama groups could, you know, their expertise, their developed expertise in producing sound drama, you know, could well be in the university, the campus. It could marry up, it could partner professional theatre groups so that, you know, I imagine, you know, new writers in theatre would find it fascinating to have the opportunity to transform their stage theatre script into a sound drama version. So then in the every year, every day funding process for the dramatic arts and screenplay, if the funding organisations for the state or private got used to the idea that audio sound drama could be added on at a very realisable and modest cost. And you know, when you take into account that BBC budget for 1 hour of television, film, drama is £1 million, and the BBC budget for 1 hour of radio drama, sound drama, is between £20,000 and £23,000. You can see how economical radio drama is. So if you've got a film project, a theatre project that's already cast, allocated the artists, the actors, the director, and the producers, and the sound designers, doesn't involve a huge amount of extra work, and I suppose, you know, production administration to move on and to add a sound drama dimension. Then there could be a way of persuading CBC to come back to radio. I wouldn't presume to give advice to another country and, you know, another complex and rich culture. I'm sure people are thinking about it, but I think it would be absolutely wonderful. Rather than being critical or negative, I think I'd like to say it would be wonderful for CBC to be in a position, hopefully supported by federal government in the grant funding for broadcasting, to return to its investment and support of sound dramas as a way of celebrating, marking Canadian novelists, Canadian poets, Canadian stage dramatists, stage drama, and providing an environment, a proscenium arch for its own voice in radio drama. Since there's been a great history of Canadian radio drama, and the radio drama academic study and writing and publications of very high quality, there's every reason why it should continue. A re-blossoming, a rebirth, a rejuvenation. Perhaps that could be an inspiration to Australia, to the other English-speaking countries in the world, and to New Zealand, to follow suit and to expand rather than contract, to revive what is very powerful, very special dramatic medium. It's hugely emotional, intellectual. To quote Gordon Lee, it's soul speaking to soul, which is a nicer way of representing the BBC's rather imperialist, globally aggressive maxim: nation speaking unto nation. I think the concept behind nation speaking unto nation was world friendship, but I suppose in the context of the 20th century British Empire, it was an exercise of cultural power at a time when Great Britain had a surfeit, some people would certainly argue an excess of economic and military power, albeit declining. I mean, that reminds me also of something that we discovered when we were doing radio drama for LBC. Word gets round, you're absolutely right. And popular publishers approached us and gave us a budget to produce the radio drama version of new novels, crime thrillers. Right. Writers, they were giving a big push in terms of marketing. And certainly that partnership is has great potential. I've no doubt at all, with passion, enthusiasm, and quality, word will get round, and sound drama and radio drama, storytelling on the radio, can have a much much bigger place, can be funded, and I hope can support and develop careers.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it enormously.
And we were here with Tim Crook. And don't go away, we'll be right back here at CITR 101.9 FM.
Doxa Documentary Film Festival discovers new forms of nonfiction film, everything from mountain gorillas to cartoon ponies and the men who love them, with a special spotlight program, Secrets and Lies, that examines the art of deception. The festival is happening May 2nd to 11th. For more information, go to www.doxafestival.ca.
What are you doing Saturday, May 24th? If you're looking for one of the most fascinating, entertaining, and intellectually stimulating days of the year, come to the Vancouver campus for UBC's Alumni Weekend. General admission, including entry to all UBC gardens and museums, is free. CITR will be there too. For a full schedule of events, go to alumni.ubc.ca. Proudly sponsored by Cowell Auto Group and CITR.
And you're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. And we are still here at Scald's Hall. We were just listening to our pre-recorded interview with Tim Crook. And he was sharing some experience that he had had in producing radio dramas in competition, actually, with the BBC Radio Service in London, in his career, his writing of textbooks, his upcoming textbook that he'll have coming out next year, and his advice that he had for radio drama producers. And as mentioned in the interview, and as I've been mentioning in previous weeks, we are working on a couple of projects of that nature. It's not easy to get things like this off the ground, but we are working on these things literally night and day, whenever we can. These are projects that are important to us and that we will hopefully be able to share with the world ere long. Speaking of sharing things with the world, we here at Scald's Hall believe in giving local artists as well a chance to shine and flourish, and it has been a while since we've had one on. However, that has changed. As I had mentioned in the retrospective of the Vancouver Fan Expo, I did talk to a number of local artists who produce work that is interesting, and today, right now, we have an interview with novelist and visual graphics artist Samuel Blondhall. And so he's coming up in just a moment here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge. Because you're mine, I walk the
line. You're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Scald's Hall, and we are here with our guest, Samuel Blondhall. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Well, I'm a science fiction novelist. I've recently published my second book in the Anahita Chronicles, and book three is coming soon. Book one is hard science fiction. It's contemporary science fiction, so it takes place in the modern day. It's about the creation and first use of the starship Mercury. Crew of the starship Mercury prepare for a short trip to Mars, both to test a miraculous new engine and to serve in an assistance capacity to the first landing team to set foot on the red planet. Sabotage and mutiny strand the Mercury and all hands deep in uncharted space, the ship damaged and the crew subject to the horrible stress of knowing they may never see the Earth again. They accidentally stumble across something amazing that will shake our understanding of the universe and our place in it. So it's really a story of action and adventure. It's technology and science, but not in such a way that it should frighten off the reader. As I said, it's about the creation and first use of the starship Mercury. That would be the project of the chief engineer, NASA personnel, David Weber, his wife, Sarah Weber, and their team of personnel, including a navigator, a pilot, co-pilot, etc. Sabotage and mutiny strand them in deep space. They do discover a strange new world, alien beings. Book one is the story of survival, more than anything, about trying to find a way to return to Earth against impossible odds, and just trying to find a path through this new world that they've found themselves stranded on. Book two, War, which is now available, actually takes place 14 years later. It's several of the same characters returning, but there's a new and second starship in play. War is a very apt title. Some of the species they meet out in deep space are not too friendly. So you've got action-adventure in the survival sense in book one, and you've got it in the in the struggle to stay alive, to fight an enemy you couldn't have conceptualized mere days before. In book two, it's really become a whole nother animal. Starship battles to full-scale ground wars.
What was your inspiration for starting this particular series?
Back in 2009, I graduated from Van Arts with a diploma in game art and design. The economy was a little rough. I had a bit of a rough start, so I turned my attention more to writing while I was looking for work, and I was able to really dedicate myself to it and pour myself into it. I spent about 6 months just hammering on the keyboard. Science fiction has always been a passion of mine. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, Star Wars, all the classics, you know, Twilight Zone on upward. It's just something I've always wanted to really pour myself into in a large project, so having that time off and free after school was really a perfect situation for me. I turned my attention to writing and just really let myself be creative.
Was there any specific sort of inspiration for this book, any series that you were inspired by, or something that inspired you especially to do a hard science fiction series?
It's difficult to narrow it down to anything in specific. Even the programs I mentioned just a moment ago weren't really inspirations in that sense, because I've never read anything like what I've written, and that was an important part of the process for me. I didn't want to be derivative, or I didn't want to write anything that I'd seen before. So, I mean, I can say I was spiritually inspired by quite a lot. Michael Crichton, Stephen King, Star Trek, but it's very original, very new, and that I'm proud to say I've accomplished.
What was it like to try to get this particular book published after you finished it?
I think every writer goes through the process of rejection. That's a universal truth. No matter how talented you are, you're going to experience that as a young writer. And I certainly am no exception. I got turned down by several houses. I spent probably a year or more just looking for a publisher, looking for an agent. It was extremely difficult just to get in touch with them. They have professional readers who screen everything before they even look at it. Many of the local Canadian publishers are receiving thousands of manuscripts a year, and they only publish 20 or 30 books. It's a hard market to break into. It's worth doing. Don't get me wrong. I encourage anybody with a creative streak in them to explore it. But be prepared for a bit of a battle. For me, I'm also an artist, as I mentioned, coming out of Van Arts for game art and design. I was actually doing cover art for another writer under Freedom of Speech, that's my publisher. I got in touch directly with the publisher that way, managed to jam my foot in the door sideways, if you will.
You were able to use the context that you had built as an illustrator in order to get somebody to look at your manuscript.
That's correct. And he loved it, and he ran with it, and now I'm at the top of the heap.
Did you plan on making this particular novel into a series when you originally wrote it, or did that come later?
Interestingly enough, when I first started writing, it was more of a creative exercise. I had no idea how long it would go on. 115,000 words later, it was book one of a trilogy, and I knew even then that it would continue. I think now as I'm finishing book three of that trilogy, I can already see another trilogy down the road, but there's a couple other projects I want to focus on first.
And when is the third book scheduled to come out?
No exact set date just yet. Editing is a difficult process to predict. Right now I'm just putting the finishing touches on it, cleaning off a few things. It shouldn't be too long, though. I'm hoping within a few months.
Have you ever had the opportunity to do your own cover art for your books?
Yes, I do all my own cover art.
Because I know that a lot of writers sometimes are unhappy with what they see for their cover art when they finally get it.
Too often, the vision of the artist is their own, and it's unique. The writer can give direction, they can suggest certain scenes from the book be adapted, they can ask for a certain look for the characters that they want displayed on the cover, things like that. But every imagination is unique, and the artist is never going to see what the writer sees.
Speaking of writing, you also belong to a writer's guild, the South Caribou Writers Guild. Can you tell us a little bit about that organization?
Absolutely. Right now I'm based out of 100 Mile House up in the Caribou. Myself and Kimberly Vanderhorst and other local writers were looking to have a bit of companionship in our craft and talk to other people who have gone through the seeking a publisher process, and to encourage and inspire the creative and literary arts in the region. So we gathered together at the library one evening. We started the ball rolling. Things have been growing fantastically since then. We've got a large membership. We just finished a very successful poetry contest throughout the Caribou region, and we've got some big plans for the future.
Have you guys put together an anthology that you published, or are you guys going to go around and do readings for these?
Both are in the works. We've talked about an anthology, but I think that's down the road a little bit. We do have an e-zine coming up. If you go to southcaribouwriters.com, that's a caribou, C-A-R-I-B-O-O, no you. You is the animal. OO is the region of British Columbia. But if you go to southcariboutwriters.com, you can follow our website there, and there's a bit more information.
Do you guys work in any other media?
I'm not much of a poet myself, but we've got some wonderful and very skilled poets in the guild. We've had historical writers, we've had fiction writers in multiple genres. We've even had a research writer, somebody who's more familiar with creating textbooks than fiction. So we're trying to reach across the board, and anybody who's experienced in the industry. We've even been working with the local newspaper, the 100 Mile House Free Press. We've gotten several published articles through them.
You started off, you wanted to be a game designer, you said?
That's right. I've always been a gamer. I mean, our generation grew up with some incredible products in that genre. I remember getting my first Nintendo when I was 10 or 11 years old, I suppose. And I was addicted ever since, just like most every other kid I knew. For me, becoming a game designer was an extension of being an artist. I've always been an illustrator, and I've always loved to sketch and draw. I think everybody I knew as a teenager had multiple portraits done over the years. So art school was a natural progression for me, and something I really loved.
And what was it like to go to the art school?
The best year of my life, honestly. It was amazing people, wonderful instructors, an incredibly educational experience, and a very creative experience. I would love to do it again.
What was it like to search through the job market afterwards?
That I would not like to go through again. I unfortunately graduated in a very rough economy. Looking for work right after the EA layoffs and several companies had closed, I was in a market that was flooded with people with a great deal more experience than me. Even with a fresh diploma, I was unable to find work at the time. But that said, I did get a few paintings through Oathbound Eclipse. That's a D20 system paper and dice role-playing game out of Washington State. And I've done several works for commercial art since then, advertising and things like that, and it's still something I very much enjoy, so it's on the table.
What was it like to do work for the tabletop gaming industry?
Really a lot of fun. I did 7 paintings for Oathbound. I'm actually in the process of building a game myself, but that's probably a year or two away from completion yet. It's a lot of work goes into something like that, and unclear on the market's profitability, so it's more of a side project. I'm constantly impressed by the quality and the dedication of artists working out of not just our area, but all over the world. The drive to do something like that and the ability to do something like that is is very special.
What has it been like to do a project like that?
It's a calling. I don't know how to explain it beyond that, really. It's something I need to do, and it's something I love doing. As a younger man, I worked in a lot of gas stations and call centers and things like that, and I just can't see myself ever going back to that work. If it's not creative, it's not worth my time.
What about the game itself? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I could touch on it a little if you'd like. It's fantasy role-playing, action-adventure in the sword and sorcery genre. Now, I write hard science fiction, my published works, but I really am a fan of multiple genres. Sword and sorcery fantasy has always been something I've enjoyed, and it's something I'd certainly like to dive into deeper in the future. Probably the greatest challenge of it has been building a new dice system. Not too many years ago, the Dungeons & Dragons system went open license, so I could just adapt that and use it freely. And I really think it's incredible that they've done that for their players. But I'd like to try something a bit more involved, a bit more complicated. At the same time, player-friendly.
I also noticed that on YouTube you have a demo reel?
Yes. If you go to my own website at blondahl.ca, I should say that's blondahl.ca. There's links to my books and other projects there, as well as my demo reel. That was from Van Arts, several years old now. I haven't actively pursued work as an animator recently. It's something I do enjoy doing, and I could certainly dive back into if I polished my skills a little. But I think as a writer, I've really found my calling. I think I can't stop at this stage. Once I finished book one of the Anahita Chronicles, I was in love with the process, and I want nothing more than to be a writer and creator. In the video game industry, most of the time, I think, you find yourself working for other people who have created the content and the art direction, and you're told what to model and how to model it. I respect that, and it's something I enjoy, but I enjoy being the boss a little bit more. Book 3 is occurring in another galaxy. It involves another previously unseen species of aliens. I'll go ahead and get into it a bit more than I have before. I'll give you the meat, as it were. I've always wondered what it would be like if mankind encountered an alien species that wasn't just our equal, that wasn't just military might that we should fear, anything like that. But what if we came across an alien being or species that was quite literally millions of years more advanced than us? And in terms of pure theory regarding the universe, that's certainly feasible. If we find life out there, it could be comparatively Neolithic, or it could be so far advanced that we can barely understand it. In the book, working title Andromeda, I have this incredibly advanced species come across us, and not to put too fine a point on it, condemn us. So it brings the previous Anahita Chronicles, the alien beings and worlds that I've established in the series, and it introduces this terrifying foreign concept to the whole universe I've already built. It's upping the stakes even further from war, and that was a difficult thing to do.
Given the very interesting and varied path that you've taken creatively in your life, do you have any words of wisdom that you would like to share with anyone who is thinking about pursuing creativity as a career?
The arts are worth any sacrifice. The need to create is something you can't deny, or you will suffer if you fight against that need. If you're an artist, a writer, a creator, and you know, it goes beyond that, even to other passions in life. If you're a scientist, if you're somebody who has a calling, don't ignore it. Don't let people discourage you. Don't let money discourage you. There are ways around every problem you will face, and there is a light through the forest.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure. I'm at www.blondahl.ca. That's B-L-O-N-D-A-H-L. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all over the internet. I'd love it if you'd find me on Goodreads, and after you've read my books, give them an honest and open review.
And you were listening to our interview with Samuel Blondahl here at Skald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with some more content.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to The Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
And you are tuned into CITR 101.9 FM. It is coming up on a few minutes before 2 o'clock. And that was our interview with Samuel Blondahl. And before that, our interview with Timothy Crook. And before that, we had a brief moment with Dylan from CHMR. And so we had quite a bit of stuff to do today. Coming up in a few moments, we're going to be having Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam. But before that, just a couple of announcements before we go. We are still working on radio drama scripts and stuff. Things are being bandied about. Moonbats is in production, in pre-production, at least in terms of getting scripts written. We are going to be following some of the advice you heard from Tim Crook. We're going to be looking for people who can help us out. And as we know, there are quite a few people in this country who probably can help us and probably don't have any other outlet when it comes to getting radio drama off the ground. Because as far as I can tell, for broadcast radio drama, there's not a lot out there in this country, not anymore. Which is a shame, and we're going to be trying to rectify that. But anyway, we've got, for the rest of the afternoon, some wonderful, wonderful programming here at CITR. It is time to sit back, relax, enjoy our actual good weather. And a shout-out, by the way, I guess, to the people who will be convocating in a couple of weeks. I know that I'm going to be convocating 2 weeks ago from yesterday. And there are a bunch of other people who will be convocating at around the same time. I believe I looked it up. It was the 21 to the 21st to the 23rd, and then the 26th to the 28th of May is convocation time. And so I think a lot of other people may have already gone home for the summer. But for those of you who are seniors, those of you who are more than seniors, those of you who are getting degrees this spring, congratulations to you and to us all. That's a great accomplishment. Speaking of great accomplishments, we're going to be coming up with some more music here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining. Sure. That's what friends are for.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you. Sure. That's what friends are for.
From June 18th to the 22nd, it's the 8th annual Sled Island Festival, featuring over 250 bands, films, artists, and comedians spread across 30-plus venues concentrated in the downtown core and surrounding areas of Calgary, Alberta. Featuring bands such as St. Vincent, Dan Deacon, Killer Mike, Rennie Wilson, and so much more. Passes are on sale now. For tickets and more information, go to sledisland.com.
Yo!
All right, everybody, what's up? What's up? What's up? You're listening to Radio Zero. Okay, I'm going to get a little back. We were fuzzing out those microphones last week. Okay, what's up? What's up? Happy Friday. It's 2 o'clock. This is Radio Zero. You're listening to UBC Radio 101.9 FM, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm Cam. Tyler's on his way in. We got a special show today. We have the two Devereaux brothers special guesting, Eric, a.k.a. Genie Main, and Paul, a.k.a. Paul Devereaux. Huge reunion. Paul used to do this show years ago before he split to go to L.A. He's back, so we'll get to hear some weird stuff from him, I would imagine. Hold on. Wait, watch this. No. That is not working the way I had expected it to. Yo, get out of the queue. Anyway, guys, we don't get the production value that I thought we would get. Okay, let's see. Let's do a commercial. I'm going to try and figure out what's wrong. Okay, guys. Perfect.
Doxa Documentary Film Festival discovers new forms of nonfiction film, everything from mountain gorillas to cartoon ponies and the men who love them. With a special spotlight program, Secrets